Welcome to this special edition of the IRIS podcast, taken from the 2010 IRIS Forum. This edition features author Janice Galloway in conversation with Sandy Cameron, chair of the IRIS board.
Well, welcome, Janice. You've had a nightmare of a day.
Yes.
Including a flat battery.
It's all going to be better now.
Literally in the nick of time. So we are literally winging it, both of us, with this session. However, we are going to be talking about particularly Janice's recent book, which is This Is Not About Me. And of course, it is about you. If you haven't read it, then I could absolutely recommend it to you as a gripping story that is about Janice's early life. It is funny, it is sad, it is touching, it makes you angry about issues, and it's hugely insightful about some of the things that we in the business that we're engaged in are concerned about. And as I think Alison was saying to you, it was thought that it would be useful to hear from Janice.
Is this Alison Petch, Sandy?
Yes, and there she is.
I do remember you.
Janice, I wonder maybe as a starting point you would like to read a bit from the book. There are many passages that could be picked.
It depends. The starting place I'm coming from is I used to be a welfare rights worker. I was one of the very first welfare rights workers, and if they were ever needed anywhere, it was in Salkett. And it was during a break from university. And I knew what we did. People came in and we gave them information. It wasn't always helpful information. It wasn't always what they wanted to hear. But I knew what we did. The kind of thing you guys do, and of course, within that word guys is the metrosexual women included, is changing. It changes so much. And public perception of what you do is probably quite different. It's probably about 10 years behind what you actually do. So when Sandy said choose a reading, he suggested three things that would take me about 3/4 of an hour to make a way through. Reluctant that you should miss out on any of your lunch, I'll pick just one of them. Bill Clinton famously said, we're all from dysfunctional families. I think that's true. But I come from an era where, and for once in an audience, I can see people who are roughly my generation, that's nice, and some people who will know what I'm talking about from mums or even grandmothers, heaven forfend, that in the 50s and 60s, nobody told you a bloody thing. The watchword of families was secrecy. What the outside doesn't know, the outside don't deserve to know. Never give yourself away, if at all possible. And the book opens with a picture. I'd like to show you the picture. That's my mother, that's me, and that's my sister. I'm the wee one in the middle. Yes, I know I look like my sister, but better. You have to put that bit there. But the family were always a three. To start with, it was me, my mother, and my dad. My mother left my dad for reasons which will become apparent. I'll start with him. And there was two of us for a tiny, tiny little window of time, which I remember as fantastic. We were living in a box room above a doctor's surgery. When you put the divan down to go to sleep, there was nowhere to walk. You had to climb over the bed to put the electric fire off. And if I was going to have a bath, it was in a tin tub. This makes me sound like my grandmother. If I was going to have a bath, it was in a tin tub in front of the fire. And paradoxically, the bath water, do any of you remember this, got hotter and hotter. It was like being the missionary, being boiled alive every time you had a bath in front of the fire, but there was nowhere to walk around it. That was bliss, because it was just us two. I firmly believe, from the experience I've had in my life, and I'm sure you've seen it too, a lot more than I have, that it's not necessarily where you live or the amount of money in your background that makes the difference between misery and happiness. It's the attitude of the people you're living with. It's not what you get, it's who you get that makes the most extraordinary difference. And that fantastic period was the me and mum bit. She'd got away from an abusive alcoholic. There was just me and her. And then my sister showed up. It was frying pan and fire. We got away from Dad, and then we ended up in another threesome. And there we are. Just one look at my sister tells you she's troubled. I had to look at her every day, and the trouble was more than what was apparent. But just because it's here, I think I'll start with what the normal texture of the household was like. It was also not normal in the 50s and 60s to ever think of yourself as in any way unusual. It's partly that Scottish thing where you somehow, I don't know, you somehow think you're special if you're in any way different, and that includes being unhappy. Who do you think you are? Applies to a whole lot of things. And you just got what you got. You got the people who were around about you. I didn't think of Dad as dysfunctional. I didn't think of Mum as this. You did. The word didn't exist, I don't think. It possibly did in textbooks, but it didn't exist in people's mouths. You just got what you got, and you got on with it. There were no diagnostic categories for what on earth was wrong with my sister, although I imagine there'll be a fair few of them now. And life was just how it was. Small children, I think, also are not judges. You take what you get, you take the hand you're dealt, you take the lunch you're given, and that's it. That's yours to deal with. You probably noticed by this time I'm running out of words and I'm still ferreting for my specs. Could anybody loan me a pair? Alison, you owe me a loan of a pair. Right. Fantastic. Can't see a thing. Right, here we go. You knew my father was in because of the way the air sat in the house. It was a displacement of dust. Something animal that gave him away, something animal that picked him up, sent a message for your chest to go tight, your ears to prick up. In the right mood, I could feel him through walls. I was three. It was the sensation of being in an open field and losing the hand you thought you were holding and the ground beginning to sink underfoot. I had no other comparisons. This was what being in a house felt like. My father was clumsy. It was the family legend. He dropped things, he crashed things, he fell off pavements, the books fell off the shelves and the pens burst every time he touched them. He lost three fingers in a wartime cock-up with heavy water that had his name on. By the time we'd been at Well Park Road for a year, all the neighbours must have known it as well. Eddie Galloway was a series of accidents waiting to happen. Indoors, between ourselves, his accidents took on a different quality, as though we were haunted. Our house was full of cracks and breakages, grazes, burns. These things just happened despite us. They were often unobserved, at least by me, and their origins were seldom attributed or admitted, but they happened all right. The evidences were around us all the time. I started to work out that they happened most often when he came home with that funny stumble in his step and his voice, awkward and sliding, his hands not able to do his shoelaces, when he was what my mother called in no fit state. And she told me to go to bed. Off you pop, even if it wasn't time. Off you pop wasn't a suggestion, it was an order. Lying awake in the dark and waiting for her to come through, as she always did eventually, you would hear these sounds like somebody clearing a cupboard outside. Soft thuds, the odd muffled exclamation of surprise, annoyance, growling in the throat, and sooner or later, if not that day, the next, something would fall, something would smash, something would tear apart. In the mornings, there'd be another scuff in the skirting, or you'd find a dent in the door. The chipboard panel would have a peephole through to the brown insides. Now and then, I would find a piece of something, an unherded fragment that had shot under a settee with jaggy edges. Oh, that was just something that broke, my mother would say, if she said anything at all. You watch, you don't cut your fingers. It was stuff's fault. Stuff just broke. We had a poltergeist called Butterfingers. Shh, she'd say, one finger up to her mouth. Don't go in the living room, hen, you'll wake him up. Shh, and we'll get some peace for 15 minutes. That was the most important word in my mother's vocabulary. Shh. Peace was achievable through silence. Something we did, something as incidental as waking him up, would trigger things that every instinct said you shouldn't trigger. I learned to stay beside doors and windows when he got up, shoeless, and kept my eyes keen and my head down, watching sidelong for clues. But our chairs kept breaking, and our picture frames cracked all the same. Once I watched him pick up my trike and throw it against the outside wall. The whole thing bounced, ricocheting off the concrete bin store, buckling and splintering till it stopped. And my mother sat down next to it, next to all these twisted pieces, and stared not at him, but at the bits. He was staring at her, but she didn't look back. She was staring at the bits, her mouth open but speechless, as though the trike had just exploded of its own accord. It broke, she said later, when my auntie asked what had happened to it. Even knowing I'd seen what had happened to it, that was what she said. Never mind. Anyway, you're too big for a trike now, aren't you, Hen? He said nothing. Of course he didn't. It was things that did it, not him. They just burst. A mean conspiracy of objects and fate. My dad was just accident prone. He lost money. He had a nosebleed that ruined his hankies. He got sick on his tie. Once he got it on his socks. You couldn't think how it got there. Other times he'd come home bright as a steel button. Oh yes, my mother said, see in the right mood and with enough drink, your dad is the life and soul. He'd find strangers and bring them in after closing time, ruthlessly jovial at his own kitchen. Men you never saw again that sat down with their feet under the table as though they belonged there and asked me what my name was, my age. Do you know your Eddie's spit? Conversation exhausted, they'd tell me to fetch them a glass, a cigarette or matches. They'd want to know if my mother was in and call my dad Eddie, as though they had a perfect right to know what his name was. And my dad would sit me on his knee and show me off and bounce me on his precarious lap and tell me to sing. That was the thing I was good at. Sing, Hen, gie's a song. It never lasted, though. Beth would appear, my mother fully dressed because there was guests of sorts, whether she knew who they were or not, ready to scoop me back to bed as though it just occurred to her that she'd forgotten me and she happened to be passing. But everybody knew she'd had to get up on purpose. Everybody knew he'd got me out of bed on purpose. I knew and she knew and he knew, even the men knew. You could see them looking sheepish briefly, but they didn't shift. Who shifted was her, and who she shifted was me. It was then when he'd won, she would turn to go with me under one arm, no questions asked, and he'd lose the bright mood and opt for dark. We didn't get you out of your bed, eh? Me and my pals. She kept walking. You'll be keen to show us some hospitality then. Look after the company, maybe make us something to eat. Hey, Beth. The life and soul. Things, it was understood, as we left the room to the laughter, the slink of glass might get broken. Most times we would come home alone and spend ages just sitting on the hall carpet and my mother would have to coax him to bed. Take your shoes off, Eddie. Come on, help me loosen the laces. Let's get you right. And I'd fall asleep hearing his name, my mother's voice soft in the hallway. Come on, sit down. I'm helping you. Don't push me out the way. Eddie. 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 And I think partly for my sake, that was one of the milder parts of the book. He did all sorts of bizarre things. And I think for my sake, my mother left him. She'd been married for 22 years to this man. And then just as I think she had been thinking about leaving, my sister was settled. You know the lovely warmth of that word to a mother when their eldest daughter is settled? In her case, it meant moved to Glasgow, out the way, pregnant, never coming back. My mother must have thought she was in the clear. And her waters broke when she was doing the washing. And that was the first she knew I was on the way. She thought I was a broken washing machine. Previous to that, she had thought I was the menopause, but I wasn't. And I think for my sake, lumbered, as it were, with another small child, she left. And then, guess what? My sister wasn't settled. She left her man, she left her baby, and she came back. However, that's enough for the time being.
But your mother managed to be, it seems to me, anything, a kind of huge protective factor. So much of her energy is, in that story, put into trying to protect you from this life that your father potentially was creating in the home.
Yeah, I think it's still a female pattern to think if something's wrong in the home, it's your fault. Yeah. You're the mediator. You were the one who gave birth. There's no getting away from that. You know, my mother used to tell jokes about, she was a terrible racist, my mother, and she used to tell Irish jokes about the Irish lassie that said to her mother she was pregnant, and the woman said, "Are you sure it's yours?" That, you know, that kind of thing. There is no denying culpability by a woman for having the baby. Whereas I think a number of men certainly used to. I have to say, my own son, the men who surround me in my life now are men I had no idea existed when I was wee. I had no idea, because there was a general, I think the post-war men had come home to something they didn't want to come home to. They'd seen things they hadn't wanted to see, and a lot of them were frozen. They were completely frozen. There was almost no getting through. They felt if they spoke, they were going to say the wrong thing. So they shut up and they disappeared inside bottles, some of them. Yeah. And
you have that sense that your father lives this life in isolation.
Yeah, he's on his own.
Yeah.
Every so often he brings these pals around, but the pals were only there when he was drinking. It was almost as though there was an excuse. And it's extraordinary, that relationship between the central belt of Scotland and alcohol being an excuse, a get-out, a let-out for some kind of emotion. Gentlemen, I've seen people use football the same way. It's a chance for a greet, it's a chance for a cuddle. And if you're drunken at the football, anything goes. Absolutely anything goes. My dad was not interested in football, but he was very interested in drink. And I think that was when he felt strong enough to talk, but it was other men.
But even as it seems to me, even though you don't describe it as such, that part of your life was spent very much in fear. The business that you describe about walking around the walls, being at the windows when he was around, and because of that sense of what will happen next, what will break, and that then, as the story goes on, kind of characterises you as you go to school, and this kind of sense of not being certain, where can you place yourself, what can you do, that results in the interest of me in terms of an intervention in your life of the speech therapist.
The speech therapist, bless her, Miss Shand. Her real name was Mrs. McGuinness, and I can say that because she's probably dead. Mrs. McGuinness was the first professional who intruded upon our lives, because I had by that time, I think when you're schooled from being very small, and I was sharp, I was quick in the uptake, so I learned very quick. And you know, when you said walking along, I used to go to bed by feeling the wall, just in case. Just we're never sure what was around the corner. And school was in some ways a release and an escape, but you didn't trust the teachers. If your first intervention in life is a bunch of teachers and they are contradictory. Now, ladies and gents, you've all been through the education system with me. Did you believe everything your teacher said? One more word, that's all. One, and someone's for it. There was always somebody that called their bluff. Always some idiot, usually the boy that sat behind you, who called the bluff. Or when they said, something is going to end, if in 5 minutes this hasn't stopped, was a recipe for a riot. This is stuff that, you know, they shouldn't have said. And you were taught to mistrust the displays of authority in a strange way by school, unless very occasionally you did get, well, not even very occasionally, at half the time, which is a high percentage, half the time you got teachers who were in the job because they loved it. They actually liked wins. I have met so many teachers who dislike Wayne's, and you think, what are you doing here? But the ones who do like Wayne's, well, the kids know. Again, you've been through the system. You knew which teachers liked teaching you stuff, were looking for that wee light up in your eyes when a penny dropped. That's what they were after. That was their reward. They weren't bankers doing it for the money or they'd leave the country. They were doing it for love. They were doing it for enjoyment. And for that reason, they did it very well. So some of them you knew to trust, but it was all a matter of instinct, and the instinct had been honed in the house. So the teachers came first. But of course, because I was nervous, by this time I had a grade A stammer. Yeah. And I had, I'm partially deaf in one ear. My sister used to hit me a lot in the same ear, and I developed ear problems. And schools in those days weren't as geared up as they are now to watch for that kind of thing. And it was the easiest thing in the world to hide bruises, but it was quite difficult to hide an ear problem. Because if the teacher asked you a question and you were at the back and you were going, what? They knew perfect something was wrong with your ear. So the first thing was I got brought down the front, then they realised I had a stammer. And my mother got taken up to school. Now, being taken up to school to meet the interventionists meant only one thing. Come on, what does a letter from school mean? You know as well as I do. Urwain's in trouble. What's she done? What's she done was the first thing. What you had to present to the outside world was a cover-up. And I think that's why I began with a picture. Life in those days, I think even now, is cover-up. It's about looking good. That was a man that came round. We didn't used to have cameras as readily available. And a man came round, and that to me is redolent of how life was lived. You dolled up. Nobody dolls up like the working class for a wedding. Nobody. And we dolled up to a band playing. But what we went home to was quite different to the way we wanted to look on the record. And that's the kind of people, I guess, that you're more used to dealing with these days than I am.
But the sense with this speech therapist was that neither you, nor importantly your mother, understood what this was about. This was an intervention in your life that wasn't explained. A bit earlier on we were hearing about how often services are provided without them being clear about why they're there or what they're doing.
Well, it was not an awful lot of education was like that again at the time. I think if the whole basis of intervention in a child's life is an explanation of why this is there and some degree of cooperation, being asked. I don't mean being expected. I mean being asked. Do you want this?
Yeah.
And sometimes it may take several askings. But even to do the asking, even if you decide to override the answer, I think that this is about you. You know, this is about you, it ought to be. And when the letter came, it was just, my mother had to go up and put on a face. And they said, your daughter has a stammer. And my mother didn't address that at all. They said, do you know she has a problem in one ear? And eventually she said, is she doing her homework? And the headmistress said, yes. And she said, well, I'm away. I've got stuff to do. If she's not being naughty, what the hell am I doing here? When I got outside, I got a belt in the ear and told, you haven't got a stammer, behave! Because that had drawn attention. The main thing was not drawing into, because it was always being answerable. Yeah. Teachers were like policemen. Mm. If one of them came to the door, your neighbours would talk. Yeah. And I'm sure that's something you know from your profession as well. People talk. You don't want that sign that there is distress.
Yeah. But that bit that you spoke about, teachers who, and you know them, and that's certainly been my experience, are the ones who want to be teachers and essentially who like kids, and that's not true of everyone. And for us, I think there is an issue that says in social work you need to like people, but not necessarily everyone who's there does that. And it's a valuable kind of insight into what makes the difference.
Well, you can understand that. Some people are very hard to like.
Absolutely.
You know, some people some people don't make it at all easy. And then I think what you have to end up doing is making a hierarchy of who you have to put first. And that must be the toughest bit of the job. You have to end up saying, you know, well, I can see where he's coming from, I can see where she's coming from, but this is the one that's in trouble. So they just have to, you know, some kind of move has to be made.
But there has to be that personal involvement that's not simply about doing this as a job.
No.
Because that's the bit that you picked up as a child with teachers, and I think is likewise there for people who use services in one way or another.
Some of the teachers were great, but I was just too suspicious. It wasn't till I got to secondary school And I trusted my instincts a lot more. My instincts when I was a child were entirely honed to, what do you want me to say? And I would look into your eyes long enough to work out what it was you wanted me to say, and that's what you'd get. And that way you would leave me alone. Yeah. It was important just to be left alone. Yeah. Come secondary school, I found a teacher with something I wanted. Mm. Now that makes a hell of a difference. Yeah. If you can offer somebody something they really want, then they'll come to you. You don't need to go to them. And I found a music teacher who was a kind of surrogate dad. He was the first person ever to, but our family didn't touch. And Ken used to put his, he'd get, would he get into trouble for this these days? Do you know this now?
Very possibly.
Would he be allowed to touch me?
No.
Ken was the first, he put his hand on my shoulder and he'd say, that's great. Nobody had ever said that to me. And I wanted more. Yeah. What kid doesn't want more? You're doing it right. Yeah. That is a fantastic thing to say to a kid. Not when they know it's shit. Okay, it can go too far. Everybody's painting was lovely. You know perfectly well that painting's crap and yours was a lot better. You want some kind of kudos. You want some kind of genuine, believable. Again, it's this risk of believability.
Yeah.
And I trusted Ken. He didn't tell me I was great often, but he said it. Yeah. And the sheer buzz of that. He was interested in classical music. And so bizarrely, from a home that had absolutely no context with classical music, that was what I gravitated towards. I wanted that thing that had made Ken like that. If that could do that and make you a person like that, I wanted that.
Yeah.
And that was what made the big difference. He had something I wanted, not the other way around. The speech therapist wanted to dose me with something. Dose me with something. And oddly, the thing she wanted to dose me with weren't language exercises, it was manners. It was manners.
Yes.
Do you know, you never ever say, what a nice hat, Miss Shand. She said to me once. I thought, what are these lessons about? You know, they say it to him, do you want a sweet or not? And if you want one, will you say thank you? What do you think? I don't want one of your sweets, do you know? It was the most immediate. Everything was a trap to see if your manners were in the right place. What matters is giving something real and genuine with meaning. You can poison a child by talking positive rubbish as much as you can poison a child by talking negative rubbish. What you have to say has to mean something. Has to be a hand coming out to hold yours. And it was Ken. He was the first.
And that was the importance of that individual that made the transformation for you in your life.
Absolutely. Yes. I would not be here if it wasn't for Ken Etherington. I think about him every single day. He gave me classical music. I mean, when I came to write a book about a classical musician, Clara Schumann, her behaviour seems unthinkable. Her father was a brute. And she kept going back to him and kept, and you think, what's wrong with her? Is it just being a 19th century German that does that to you? You just keep going back like a dog to its vomit. There's just some, what the hell is going on? And then I thought, you gave her the music. You never forget that. You never stop being grateful.
What do you think about the role of writing and how that might play? I had in the past experience of a writer in residence who happened to be Alison Kennedy, now A.L. Kennedy.
And the impact, you can still call her Alison.
Absolutely. But just for the
don't
audience.
Be afraid of this.
But who made a huge impact in people's lives by helping them to learn that they could write and find another way of expressing themselves. Do you think, as a writer now, with all this experience, that maybe that's something we might look at by we're talking about innovation? How can you help draw out that experience?
Well, I get my knowledge of psychoanalysis is fairly penguin paperback, but what writing is about, I feel on a lot firmer ground talking about what writing is about. Yeah. And one of the reasons I came to writing this was that the NHS, after 20 years, gave me a psychoanalyst to see once a week, and I wouldn't talk to him. It was beyond my control. I would walk in thinking, I'll talk about this, I'll talk about that, I'll talk about the next thing. The most important thing was my makeup. I had to look right. I was still posing for a photo. I had to look right when I went in, and I wore waterproof mascara because I wasn't having it running. You know, it was just the absolute iron determination. And then I thought, well, if you need to be in control that much, you can't even ruddy talk. You might say something, and I couldn't talk to him. So I wrote that. I wrote that and gave him it after a few years, because it had the same effect. Being with him gave me a key to unlock the bit of me. It was safe. Yeah. If I hit something that made me feel scared, there was somebody there who was being paid to catch me, and it was the pay. A working class girl, somebody being paid is probably going to come up with the goods because they respect the money the way I respect the money. There is something about being paid that makes it legitimate to turn to them for help. That's why it's a big shock if a nurse lets you down, if a policeman lets you down, if a social worker or a teacher lets you down, you think there's something in it for them, even if they don't care about me.
Absolutely.
You know, and it takes a while to learn that the caring about you is actually why they earn their money that way at all. That takes a bit of learning.
Sure.
But I've managed to put enough in there. And I think there is something about words that when you wrap something up in words, through psychotherapy, through writing music, kids sing. Yeah. Kids sing non-stop. See if you get them to write their own songs. You'd be astonished what comes out.
Yeah.
To paint pictures. Yeah. Pictures are the first form of words. Have you ever been to the caves in Lascaux? The first novel is there on the wall. There's a handprint. Can you imagine being the man or the woman who made that handprint and standing back and thinking, that's me. Look at it.
Yeah.
I've left a mark. Or this is what I see. That's what the words do. They leave a mark.
Yeah.
And suddenly you're a serious human being. Yeah. You're standing on something. And if you find the words to wrap what you feel up, it's got it out of you. You don't need to cut anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
The words come out. I think it is valuable.
This is personal. I've got to ask you, what happened to Cora?
You need to buy book two.
Book two. I thought that would be the answer. Cora is this, for those of you who haven't yet read the book, incredibly kind of violent towards you sister that you have who disrupts everything. And yet the sense is that there is equally a bright person in there struggling to get out.
My sister was a very confused individual, and at times you are bound to, I think these women are dying out, and every time you say that, a whole new batch of them appears on the horizon with whatever is the modern day equivalent of a rolling pin. My sister was extraordinary. She was gallus, she was dolled up, she chewed men up and spat them out. Seriously, gentlemen, if my sister was in this room, there's not one of you would be safe. She was angry about women. She used to say, there's no excuse for an ugly woman in this day and age. Can they not buy makeup? I mean, she was really furious about everything. She left her husband, left her child, and you find out. And so on the one hand, I admired her. She was fantastic. She was a Christmas tree with all the fucking lights on all the time. She was extraordinary. But she was brutal, she was cruel, because clearly this face was costing her something. And I was the weeest. That was why I wanted a pet. Subconsciously, I knew that if she'd something else to kick, I'd be safe. She killed the goldfish, by the way. She killed that. I brought in a baby bird, you know that? So I brought in a baby bird and she killed that. She's a bad bitch in some ways. But in other ways, I thought she was fantastic. There's always something positive to be had there if there's any communication of any kind at all. There's something positive you can extract from it. And I found out, by the end of it, you find out what happened to Cora in more ways than one.
So we managed to get the trailer in for the next book.
Yeah,
when's that coming?
It's to be handed in at the end of November. I have two more chapters to write, but I know where it's going, so it is going to finish, Sandy.
Right. If it's anything like this, then it will be a must read. This is a wonderful book that's gripping. If I can say that it reads not like an autobiography but a novel in the way that it's written and the language and how it grasps you, then that for me was the bit that made it a real page turner to say what's going to happen next to your life. And we have the outcome before us in terms of where you've got to. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to share those experiences with us. It's a fascinating book in terms of insight into what happens in families, and it is very valuable, I think, in terms of helping us think about the way that we practice and the impact that we have when we go in to try and help people. So thank you for that, and absolutely look forward to the next book.
Thank you for the invitation. Thank you very much, and good luck.
Thank you.